From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. This is what's happening. The workers at Japan's stricken nuclear power plant expect some of them will die within weeks or months. This according to the mother of one of them. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the power companies, has said that radiation leaking from the plant had seeped into underground water beneath the site. The leak is an indicator of just how far from stabilizing the dangerously overheating reactors after the cooling systems were knocked out in that March 11th tsunami. But these 50 workers believe that they will die, and they are prepared to do so. For a look at just how long radioactivity can hang around, consider Germany's wild boars. That's right. A quarter century after the Chernobyl disaster in the former Soviet Union that carried a cloud of radiation across Europe, these animals are radioactive enough that people are urged not to eat them. And the mushrooms that the pigs dine on aren't fit for consumption either. Germany's experience shows that this could await in Japan as well if the problems at the plant get any worse. A strong earthquake struck the southern portion of the Greek island of Crete on Friday, rattling buildings as far away as Egypt and Turkey. Local police say they had no immediate reports or injuries of the 6.2 magnitude quake. Mitch Batras, he's up with us now, and you know Mitch. Mitch, there's been some talk of some kind of strange rumblings from Florida all the way up to Wisconsin. People are hearing strange sounds. Is that an indicator that something could be going on?
Well, it's not the first time that we've heard of this, George. It's been some years, maybe a decade ago. It was sometimes referred to as the Taos, in Taos, New Mexico hum.
Yes.
Now, what they believed it to be at that time was underground tunnels. They were building I can't remember what it's called. It was something like the... Where they were having charged particles that collided, something very similar to the one in Switzerland or Sweden.
Sure.
So it could be something like that. As far as the Ring of Fire, which are the tectonic plate, it's not impossible that the tectonic activity could have a rumbling effect that perhaps some sensitive people could pick up. We believe animals certainly do. My good friend Jim Berkland often talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a good chance that we as humans at one time, before we became desensitized, also could pick up on that. So we do know that there's ultra-sensitive people that seem to pick up on these things. That is a distinct possibility. And in addition to that, I also believe that the magnetic field is shifting, and that has a direct correlation to the Earth's core. And, of course, the Earth core is directly related to the mantle, the crustal displacement.
Mitch, some people are predicting the big one for Southern California. You in that camp?
I think it's going to be higher up. I believe it's going to be the Cascadia subduction zone, which begins in Northern California and goes up to Vancouver, B.C., or just north of that. It's happened before. Every seismologist that I have spoke to believes that it's overdue. And the last time that it happened, it was a 9.0, perhaps a 9.1. The difference is that instead of it occurring in Japan and a tsunami coming our way, it was just the opposite. The earthquake occurred here on our west coast, and the tsunami went all the way across the Pacific and killed literally thousands of people in Japan. We see that today in Japan. So I think what could be causing the earthquake activity, the increase of earthquake activity and volcanism, is the lessening of our magnetic field, which has a direct correlation to the Earth's core. Everything is tied into the sun. And now what we're learning, very much so, is that the sun, in addition to its cyclical events, has a rhythm with our galaxy, Milky Way. And they've kind of zeroed in. Just yesterday was published a paper talking about the mysterious, what they're calling a ribbon, which is really a string of charged particles that seems to bond solar systems within our own galaxy. Now, there I go, George. Going to Mayan prophecy, but I'll stay focused on the earthquake. Oh, by the way, you missed the Fiji earthquake, which occurred just yesterday, a 6.4. Luckily, a tsunami, no tsunami was issued. So it's remaining extremely active, in all around the Ring of Fire. But it's those unexpected places, George, that you and I have talked about from time to time, such as the New Madrid Fault. So when earthquake activity starts to occur in Texas and Oklahoma, and then anywhere around the New Madrid Fault, then that's something to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Mitch Batras's website, earthchangesmedia.com. Highway deaths have plummeted to their lowest levels in more than 60 years, helped by more people wearing seatbelts, better safety equipment in cars, and efforts to curb drunk driving. The Transportation Department estimated that 32,788 people were killed on U.S. roads last year, a decrease of about 3% from 2009. It's the fewest number of deaths since 1949 during the presidency of Harry Truman, when more than 30,000 people were killed. A plane was diverted to an Ohio airport after two flight attendants reported dizziness and four other passengers simply fainted. American Airlines spokespeople say that the pilot dropped oxygen masks when the dizziness was reported. The Dayton International Airport director says the pilot alerted the airport that some passengers were complaining about the air quality. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. His two-year fight to shield crisis-squeezed banks from the stigma of revealing their public loans protected a lender to local governments in Belgium, a Japanese fishing cooperative financier, and a company part-owned by the Central Bank of Libya. Dexia, which is based in Brussels and Paris, borrowed as much as $33.5 billion through its New York branch from the Fed's discount window lending program, according to documents, in response to a Freedom of Information Act request. Dublin-based DEFA Bank, taken over in 2007 by a German real estate lender and later seized by the German government, he took in $24.5 billion. The biggest borrowers from the 97-year-old discount window as the program reached its crisis era peaked were foreign banks, accounting for at least 70%. Of the $110.7 billion borrowed during the week in October of 2008, when the program surged to a record. Here's Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, they've been trying to keep this a secret, and things are starting to leak out. And to me, it's unbelievable. How about you?
Well, this got put all the way to the Supreme Court, George. So they had no choice. It's been a three-year fight. And, of course, we know the reporter who started it, Mark Pittman, very heroic reporter, died at a young age of a heart attack in the process. So it was quite a bitter fight. What it shows, George, is to be expected. In other words, the Fed and the Treasury do not finance a sovereign nation. They're financing a global empire.
That's right.
And the reality is, during the 90s, the global empire, under the leadership of the Fed and the Treasury, issued significant amount of intentionally fraudulent paper, including mortgage securities fraudulent paper, and some of it government guaranteed. And so a decision was made when the Ponzi scheme started to unravel to essentially finance everybody holding their fraudulent positions. In other words, we sold them crap, and we took the position we're going to stand by our crap. And, you know, I've said before, I think the reason that Barack Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize is he really engineered one of the most fantastic political feats in the history of Western civilization, getting Americans to go along with, you know, essentially refinancing out the crap. And the important reason why we need to look at this story is, you know, we have some of the Fed presidents saying, well, they paid us back. Well, the reality is they paid us back with debased dollars. And that means savers around the world and taxpayers have really gotten hurt. And it means that, yet again, the fraud and the guys who are playing dirty are taken out, while the people who played fair, square and fair, are not protected. And so the money's going to the sick as opposed to the healthy. And at the end of the day, that's going to hurt the healthy. If you can, every time your business gets in trouble, you get taken out with 0% financing that debases me, it's not going to take too long before you buy up, and own my company and my land and everything else. So the discrepancy between constantly financing the fraudulent as opposed to the healthy is part of the challenge. And, of course, this amount of lending is debasing everybody, which is what has the saver so upset. So this is going to be a very healthy conversation as we go through. It was about 27,000 pages of documents. So we've only begun to see the tip of the iceberg. Is the Bloomberg's going to have a lot of investigative reporters going through this, but apparently they've put this up online. So, there's going to be a lot of smart financial people going through this, and we're going to learn a lot in the next 30 days.
Well, let's see if anybody goes to jail for this, Catherine. I probably doubt that anybody will. Bernie Madoff, the convicted investment advisor, said that the entire U.S. government financial system was based on a Ponzi scheme, and he might be right. Thanks, Catherine. Up next, we're going to be talking about the poltergeist phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Our guest, Michael Clarkson, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. Investigative reporter Michael Clarkson has won many awards for his writing and research, including a Pulitzer nomination for his Rendezvous with the Reclusive author J.D. Salinger. His most recent work of 6 books is The Poltergeist Phenomenon, and Michael is considered an authority on fear as well. Fascinating couple hours tonight with Michael Clarkson here on Coast to Coast. Michael, how are you?
Good. Thanks, George. I'm a little tired here. It's about 1 o'clock in the east, but in the morning, but I'll try to get through it.
We'll push you for a couple hours, and you'll be okay.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about your background and also your investigation into the poltergeist phenomenon. I find this fascinating.
Sure. Well, George, I come to this subject as a skeptic by nature and by environment. 37 years, and the print media will do that for you.
Yeah.
I covered cops for many years, and I try not to become cynical, but I've always been skeptical. As you know, in the newspaper business, people are always trying to sell you things. That's why you become a little, a little wary when people come with big claims. But I started following this case. Maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but I started following poltergeist very slowly. Actually, it's been on the back burner probably for 30 years, believe it or not. I've written many, many books on fear, which have been probably a little more fact-based than this, although I hope I have some facts in this book. But I come to this, as a primarily a skeptic, but I think I'm a little more open-minded seeing what I've found.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about fear for a moment, Michael, because that'll lead us into the poltergeist phenomenon. And by the way, the Pulitzer family hired me here in St. Louis back in 1978 to work at one of their television stations at the time. And that was when they also owned the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And they were the last of the folks with what I felt journalistic integrity. They were incredible people when it came to leaving their reporters and staff alone to go get a story, Mike.
Yes, ironically, you mentioned I was up for the Pulitzer Prize. Well, that year, 1980, Phoney won it. A woman by the name of Janet Cook, she made up a story about drugs and young people, and she ended up winning it for a fiction piece. But the Pulitzer people, you're right, they have high integrity, and they ended up taking it away from her.
Let's talk about fear now. When you researched fear, was it based on a scientific approach in terms of why people are scared of things?
I think both, George. Having a police background, I saw a lot of fear up close. I worked undercover, talked to a lot of cops, covered a number of inquests, one of which really got me going on fear. This coroner's inquest into cops killing, tragically, this teacher, and they said they saw the action in slow motion. It seemed like the gunman turned around slowly and seemed to give them more time to shoot. And the independent witnesses got up and said, no, things happened in normal fashion. So the cops looked like they were liars on the stand. And then an expert got up and said this was a phenomena from the fight-or-flight system known as tachypsychia, which is Greek for speed of the mind. I think it's nature's way of giving us the action in a crisis situation one frame at a time. So it seems, George, like things are like a video camera on fast forward. It goes slower, but nature gives us the action one frame at a time in order to let us deal with the challenge ahead of us. Now, this doesn't happen every day, of course, but I think probably all of your listeners out there may have a fight or flight experience once in their life, whether it's an automobile accident or some tragic accident where they feel like their life is threatened, and they can probably relate to going through a whole series of changes in their mind and body. And I think that is somewhat related to poltergeist activity. But most of my previous books, yes, were on fear, and probably we could do another show about that, because I became so embarrassed about my own life when I found out just basic things, what I think most people don't realize about fear, how much impact fear has in our daily lives. Example, I found out that the average person has 66,000 thoughts a day, and 44,000 of those, George, are negative thoughts or worries. And when I found out that only 8% of those 44,000 or 40,000 thoughts or worries were legitimate, then that made me think, well, what garbage am I having coming through my brain? And what ridiculous things am I worrying about? That kind of changed my life right there. But to make a long story short, I also found, I believe, some science to this, but most stress, I think, in our lives is something I call fear energy. In other words, when you feel tense, when you're anxious, it doesn't have to be a life-threatening situation. There may be somebody on the other end of the phone you're angry with, and you feel tension in your shoulders. There's only one reason for that, George, is your fight or flight system has kicked in and is pumping this adrenaline and fear energy throughout your body to help you deal with a situation. Of course, we're not faced with mastodons and warring tribes these days, but our fight or flight system is the same as it was in the caveman days, and it doesn't know the difference. So it kicks in any time when we feel or our brain feels that we're threatened in some way. And I think the average person, believe it or not, has their fight or flight system kick in 35 to 40 times a day, albeit in small increments, in the very small ways, anxiety, I say the tension in the shoulders. But I also found, George, to cut this segment off, that we can use this fight or flight if we're very formula about it. I came up with a formula to try to change my hormonal chemistry when I was under stress. Now, I said I was under deadline pressure. Most of those 37 years, I worked for the next day's paper, so I felt stressed to meet deadlines. I've also been an amateur athlete, and I came up with this formula to change my fear when I was choking under pressure to passion, using anger to change my hormonal chemistry, and then plugging it into whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's reporting or playing in a basketball game. And I found that could put me into the zone. In fact, it gave me what I would describe as out-of-body experiences. Now, I didn't exactly move things with my mind, as we'll talk about with poltergeist, but I do think there's a link, a strong link, between anger, fear, fight or flight, and this poltergeist phenomena.
Michael, great sports athletes like Mickey Mantle in baseball, Gordie Howe in hockey, they say they had the ability to slow the baseball down when a pitcher threw it, or to slow the hockey puck down when it was passed to him, in order to do what they did and achieve greatness. You know, after just listening to you and some other people I've talked to over the years, I'm convinced they truly had that ability.
Yes, George, I think we're dealing with a couple of things here. First of all, the people you mentioned, you can mention any high achiever in any business, any sport. I think they're born adrenaline sensitive. In other words, they're born predisposed to handle crisis situations. They channel their adrenaline into a positive way rather than a negative way. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got the training of the athlete, and you've got the innate skills. So in that respect, they may be able to slow down the ball. But secondly, when we're talking about a crisis situation in sports, when we're talking about the ninth inning in a baseball game, we're talking about Michael Jordan having to make that crucial free throw, then I think their fight or flight system kicks in, and that acts as an additive to the skills they already have, so it slows the action down even further.
That's a good point. Stay with us. Next up, the Poltergeist Phenomenon on Coast to Coast AM. And later on Coast to Coast AM, we'll have those special open lines for you. And next hour, we'll take phone calls about your own poltergeist experiences. And up next, we'll be talking with Michael Clarkson, his incredible investigative work into the poltergeist phenomenon. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. I think it's fantastic when an investigative reporter or a journalist with the credentials of Michael Clarkson get involved in investigating the supernatural and the unknown, because that's what this entire field needs. And Michael, you've done a great job with the poltergeist phenomenon. Congratulations with that.
Thank you. Was that you singing as Frankie Valli during the break, or was that a recording, George?
I wish it was me.
Love that. Thanks for the compliment.
It's one of those classic. Now, tell me what you feel the difference is between a ghost and a poltergeist.
Things that go bump in the day. I think that's a basic difference. I think poltergeist activity can go in the day or night, where I guess most hauntings, I'm not an expert in ghosts, are generally at night. And the reason I think for that, George, is that we're dealing here with poltergeists, with haunted people rather than haunted buildings. In fact, I was going to call this book originally Psychic Tantrums, and there's a link right there to fear. In fact, I think it's something to do with, I reviewed 75 cases, and I don't want to generalize because every case has its own idiosyncrasies and characteristics. However, when I reviewed 75 cases, all of them involving unusual movements of objects, like flying cups and saucers, chairs moving supposedly on their own. In most of them, the reported poltergeist energy seemed to revolve around the person in the room, most often a young person. In fact, only about 5% of the 75 cases was a spirit reportedly involved and perhaps acting through a young person to move objects. Even a chap named Alan Murdy, former chairman of England's Ghost Club Society. Now, they bill themselves as the oldest organization in the world devoted to psychical research. He said that in poltergeist cases, buildings are not haunted, but people are.
And in most cases, they're younger people. Why would that be?
It's a good question, but there seems to be a bit of a puberty angle besides the psychic tantrums. I think the high emotions and the stress has got a lot to do with youths and being in the home with perhaps with parents they think don't understand them or aren't listening to them. But it's not in all cases, but let me get back for a second, George, to the definition of a poltergeist, because some of your listeners out there may be phoning in later by saying, you know, Michael, I've got these knockings and the movements of objects. I'm sure a ghost is involved. I'm not saying that's not the case all the time, but my definition of a poltergeist, and it's basically the same as a parapsychologist by the name of William Rohl. He lives in Georgia, and he investigated hundreds and hundreds of poltergeist cases over the last 50 years. His definition, and he came up with this term RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. We may talk a little later about its direct cousin, psychokinesis, of which your listeners may be more in tune. But this defines bizarre movements of objects, noises, and other paranormal effects caused unconsciously by a person, unlike psychokinesis, which is generally thought to be a more conscious moving of things by the mind. And getting back to these common denominators, you asked about the adolescents. Well, these cases, the 75 cases, generally had an adolescent entering puberty. And he or she is usually quite intelligent. There's usually some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent by others, a high level of stress in the household prior to the start of the poltergeist activity and continuing throughout the case. So I think we're dealing with young people for two reasons. The high stress levels, obviously there's sometimes conflicts between parents and kids going through adolescent and teen years. But also there's this puberty angle. There are some people who believe that there is some sort of sexual and creative energy produced by going through puberty. In fact, I'm not a scientist or a medic, but there's a pineal gland, and reportedly it releases this sexual energy, and some people think it's also related to creative energy.
Right.
Now, that's I think only one component, though, George, of a whole mess of things we're dealing with here. I think what we're dealing with here is a perfect psychic storm. There needs to be a number of things which come together to create things moving. And I think another one of those things is that they found, examining some of these poltergeist agents or the kids after the fact, they found a high number of them have unusual brains. In other words, they have a slightly higher rate of epilepsy and schizophrenia. Now, there was a parapsychologist who's no longer with us. His name was Andrew Green of London. He said that some of the agents suffer from a front temporal lobe epilepsy. Now, that's a brain disorder in which people can suffer blackouts lasting from a minute to half an hour. And during these blackouts, an unknown power of the mind may be released, which can cause these objects to move. Now, that's complex as to begin with. However, I think on top of that, we have another layer, and it involves energy. I think these young people, and it's not always young people, we'll talk later on about a woman who's in her 40s, who's still going through allegedly a poltergeist experience.
Mm-hmm.
However, these young people with unusual brains tap into subconsciously, I think, sometimes sources of energy. In other words, it could be household electricity, could be geomagnetic storms, could be magnetic fields in the area of the building, or energy from the mind-body. I think sometimes, George, we forget we've got electricity in the beat of our heart. We have electrical signals moving along our nerve cells so that...
Our body's electric.
Yes, when you walk across the carpet and then bang, you hit the doorknob and the zap. So I think we've got a number of things at work, and I think it is a very rare instance. We're talking here about something that doesn't happen every day. I know poltergeists have been reported throughout the world and throughout history, but I still think it's a very rare and unknown event. And I think only about 12% of those rare poltergeist cases are actually investigated. So it's a hard subject to get our head around. It's a hard subject for investigators to come up with some hard evidence.
Is the poltergeist, Michael, attached to the individual, or is it attached to the environment?
Well, as I just stated, I think it's both, George. I think it starts with the individual. And I don't think these people know. They may know that they're doing it, that they're, this behavior is manifesting itself in these things moving. But I'm pretty sure they don't know how they're doing it. But they're tapping into some electricity, tapping into their immediate environment, and making things move. Now, usually they have to be pretty close to the action, from what I understand from talking to many police officers who've seen these things firsthand. The agent usually is within, let's say, 20 feet of the bizarre movements of objects.
Huh. The poltergeist itself, did the person that is being affected by this have any living lifestyle with a poltergeist before? I mean, we've talked about the difference between a poltergeist and a ghost, but what the poltergeist is some kind of energy, but was it once a living being?
Not from the cases I've reviewed. It seems that poltergeist energy, if we want to call it RSPK, comes and goes pretty quickly. In fact, most of the cases I reviewed, their longevity is perhaps a week or 2 weeks to, at the most, a month and 2 months. There's one or two cases which seem to have lasted a year. But this energy, no, I don't think it was a living being, and I think it comes and goes. Now, in some cases, and we can talk about that in a while if you want, it follows them, not necessarily in the form of RSPK or spontaneous activity, but in the form of psychokinesis. Some of these poltergeist agents in later years have learned, seemingly, consciously, to move things with their mind.
Are they demonic at all?
I don't think so. Now, I do have a whole chapter, however, on ghosts and possession. There's a Virginia psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Ian Stevenson. Now, he believes there's a link between spirits and poltergeist activity, and he sometimes suggests the victimized families that seances be held to cleanse a home. And others, yes, as you say, others believe the agent is possessed by a spirit or a demon, and they sometimes suggest a type of exorcism to bring the person back to himself or herself. However, getting back to William Rohl, who I respect in this line of work, he does not know of any case in which a spirit was responsible for a poltergeist incident. However, I quote him, he said, "We should not close our minds to that possibility, but they always seem to occur around a living person."
Michael, how did you find the 75 cases you investigated?
Well, it was a long haul. It was 30 years, as I say, on the back burner. I knew of this case in St. Catharines, Ontario, from 1970. I didn't know of it really until 1980. But it seemed such a striking case to me. I knew most of the police officers involved in the case who swore they saw this poltergeist activity. And so I started following, after 1980, I started following reports, newspaper reports of poltergeists, and trying to separate the wheat from the chaff. Some of them just seem like frauds, and I have a section in my book on outright frauds and poltergeist activity. But I started interviewing people in these stories, started interviewing people, parapsychologists like William Rohl, interviewing the police officers. And by the way, I would not have written this book if I hadn't had police officers on my back in this book, because as a police reporter, when cops go to the station and they write down the report that they've seen a poltergeist energy, they've seen things moving without human hands, then I tend to believe them, because they have so much to lose back at the cop shop, not only in ridicule, but their credibility.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and generally police officers are better witnesses than the average person. If you ask the average person, of course, five people about the same motor vehicle accident, you're going to get five slightly different stories. But the police are trained to look examine things on a fast pace, and they're also trained to be skeptical. And in all these cases, it was very clear that there was a person, usually a young person, at the center of this activity, always in the room when these things were flying around. And so the cops started looking at this person would be the number one suspect. And most of these cases, there was absolutely nothing found in the way of cheating. So the cops really are the reason that I wrote this book. And without them, I think we're dealing with many cases which have so many loose ends. As I said, it's so hard to investigate poltergeists, because the main reason is that the families are embarrassed. Families don't want media attention. Maybe they may have a troubled child, so they don't let the investigators in at all, or sometimes not until late into the case, and then usually the energy is dissipating by that time.
So the police officer primarily, Michael, is called to the scene of some kind of poltergeist activity, as opposed to coming upon a crime scene or a death scene or anything like that. This is a specific poltergeist phone call to the police department, isn't it?
Yes, and usually it's the last resort on the part of the family. Usually they're worried about flying objects. I've got a couple of really interesting cases. You want me to talk about them now?
Yeah, we've got time, sure.
Sure. Well, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, in I think it was 1977, police were called to this house after furniture, it was actually 1974, called after furniture reportedly was moving on its own, and the activity seemed to center around a 10-year-old girl by the name of Marcia, all 70 pounds of her soaking wet. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of quotes from the police officers at the scene. Patrolman John Holdsworth said he saw a 450-pound refrigerator, quote, lift slowly off the floor, turn, and then set down again. Then the big TV set seemed to float in the air and crash to the floor. I checked to see what had caused it to fall, but I saw nothing. Patrolman Joseph Tomek, I just couldn't believe what I saw. Shelves fixed to the wall began to vibrate until they were loose, then flew through the air. I looked for evidence that someone was making it happen, but I couldn't find anything, no wires, no nothing. Then I watched as the big TV fell over. And it went on and on. And actually, the fire chief was there as well. He said his men saw dinner plates rattling, pictures jumping off the wall, a television set falling over, and a heavy leather chair jumping at least 6 inches off the floor. If you want me to wrap up this case a little bit, two priests were actually called in family didn't know what to do about what the cause was, so they brought in two priests who blessed the house, but they saw nothing to suggest that evil spirits were responsible. In fact, a Reverend Charbonneau, he said it was a classic poltergeist case of psychic energy, and there was no exorcism performed in the house.
In these 75 cases, has anybody been hurt?
Yes, but not seriously. That's another one of the common denominators I found in these number of cases, that it seemed to be a mischievous intent on the part of the person, the poltergeist agent, rather than a malevolent one. Although I found about a dozen people were injured by flying objects, but none of them seriously. In fact, I don't. I stand to be corrected, but I don't think anyone has ever been killed by a poltergeist.
Does the individual, in your opinion, manifest the poltergeist where it comes from within that individual?
Yes, it wouldn't be my opinion. It's just the 75 cases, but what people are telling me basically is that, yes, we're dealing with haunted people. And because of the components all coming together, as I earlier stated, as a sort of a perfect psychic storm.
Yeah.
It's not, in other words, it's not going to happen to everyone. It's going to happen very rarely, but yes, it does seem to be coming from a person with an unusual brain, unusual powers, unusual ability to tap into nearby energy sources.
Are they particularly angry?
I think that's a word that comes to mind initially.
Yeah.
The psychic tantrum. I think, as I mentioned earlier about the fear, when you have the word danger, George, you take the D off of danger, and what do you have?
You take the D out of, you have anger.
Yes, you've got anger. I think anger is there generally as a protective device. I think we can all relate to that. When we get angry, unless it blows up in our face, for a short period of time, we can actually focus better. We're more truthful usually when we're angry. We feel more powerful. And I think this is one of the initial components in poltergeist activity. As I said earlier, there's usually some repression or frustration on the part of the poltergeist agent in the house, and then he or she becomes angry. And then I think it does set off the fight or flight system. Now, beyond that, of course, there's this poltergeist system, if that's what you want to call it. And I think that's triggered after fight or flight.
And explain that a little bit more, fight or flight.
Sure. Fight or flight is simply our age-old, million-year-old protection system. It involves hormones. It involves adrenaline, testosterone, dopamine. They all come to our rescue. We're all chemically different when we feel we're under pressure. But basically, it's made for us to fight or run away. That's why they call it fight or flight. In other words, the blood goes to your big muscles. It may go to your arms to fight, or may go to your big muscles in your legs to run away. But there are also other offshoots from, I think, fight or flight. I mean, sometimes we fake. I think faking is one of the big things these days. We huff and puff, and we pretend like we're going to start a fight to get someone to back down. But that's basically the answer for fight or flight.
Michael, as quickly as the activity manifests itself, it goes away, as you said, over the days or weeks. What makes it go away? What happens to that individual where it's gone?
We're not sure about that. One theory, however, is that the stress in the household eases, particularly if some, whether it's priests come in, some sort of clergy, parapsychologists, social workers come into the house, sometimes the stress eases. And sometimes the family comes to the bottom of that. Part of the problem is that the child is frustrated or repressed. And when that is eased in the household, then perhaps that's one of the reasons that the poltergeist energy starts to dissipate.
Does it ever come back again at a later time?
Usually not. Usually not in the form of RSPK. There's been a couple of instances where a family has moved from a house or a building thinking that the building was haunted, but the poltergeist activity followed them. There's been some families who've gone on vacation, and when they came back, the poltergeist energy is gone. But as I said earlier, it can manifest itself, I think, in psychokinesis, which is the close cousin, or RSPK. And then older in life, I've got a number of incidents here where the poltergeist agent has become an agent of psychokinesis, which is more controlled.
Absolutely. Michael, we're going to come up to the top of the hour here, and I want to come back and continue this discussion with you and also take some phone calls. Incredible work, the Poltergeist Phenomenon. Michael's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Michael Clarkson, CLARKSON.com. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM.